Hi, I'm Michael from Pittsburgh.
This is Laurel from Oakland.
Hey, I'm Allison from Cincinnati.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. The world of webcomics is a remarkable one, that is full of funny and beautiful and remarkable things, and often very geeky things. But the world of webcomics had not to this point had much in the way of humanities geekery until Kate Beaton hit the scene with her comic strip Hark a Vagrant. It draws on the worlds of history and literature extensively, taking important historical figures down a notch and generally making the world safe for, you know, librarian-type nerds. Kate Beaton, welcome to The Sound of Young America.
Thanks very much.
It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
You're from Nova Scotia.
I am, yeah.
So are there a lot of people in Nova Scotia who at, you know, 16 or 17 decide to go into a career in webcomics?
Well, I wasn't one of those people. there might be now. I couldn't speak for that. When I was 16, 17, we didn't really have the internet. It kind of trickled in a bit slower, maybe.
And this is, I mean, I should point out, when you say we didn't really have the internet, it trickled in slower.
Yeah.
I'm 30, and I think you're younger than I am, right?
28, yeah.
So when you were 16 or 17, we're already talking about the end of the 90s.
Yes. But no, it was slow coming, like everything.
When you went to college and got internet for real, I presume that's when you got internet for real.
Yeah, well, actually, I never owned a computer until I was 22, maybe. I think the year I graduated university. But I would use the computer labs. That's kind of like having the internet.
When do you think you realized the potential of the internet? Like what the significance of it was?
Oh, well, I guess that depends on what you're talking about exactly. I think
I should say for you. You know what
yes.
I mean?
Not, oh,
I mean,
for
obviously,
me.
We all learned about the information superhighway
from
Al Gore in 1994 or whatever. But,
yeah.
but like for you personally, like what the ramifications of it were?
Oh, I think that it was probably around 2007, actually. That was when I was living in Victoria, British Columbia, and I became friends with people who put their comics online, and they, you know, they saw what I was doing and said, you should do this too. You should put them on the internet. And I kind of saw how that worked out for them. And I thought, well, I should give it a shot too. And I did. And that's that.
How did that actually happen? Like, were you just drawing a picture in a notebook in a cafe and somebody came up to you
no,
and said, hey,
no.
Nice picture?
No, it was by chance. Two people I met, Ryan Pequin. He's a cartoonist, and he lives in Victoria. And I worked in a museum with Emily Horn, who is one half of the comic A Softer World. It's an online comic.
It's a very popular one.
Yeah, it's lovely. And getting to know them, I used to make albums of comics and put them on Facebook because Facebook was new then, and I thought that was a good way to share things with my friends. And you know, they saw this, and Emily was like, you really should just have your own website, because I have mine, and we do very well, and I think that you would be popular. And I thought, well, that sounds good to me. It'd be nice to be popular.
What was informing your comics at that point in your life? Were you trying to make something that was like a newspaper comic strip or like a, you know, Love and Rockets comic or what?
No, I was really unfamiliar with a lot of comics at that time. I started to try and educate myself. I would go to the comic store and ask what's good to read. And, you know, they always love that question. They're like, what? Just like shove you into some section and let you mill around. No, I was making comics about my life and about my friends, because that's what friends like to see, is themselves in a comic. You know, and then do one about me, and you go, okay, well. And it's nice to make people feel good, and that's what I wanted to do, I guess. I wanted to make my readers, who were my friends, feel good, so I was making, you know, little jokey in joke type stuff, and then history stuff on this on the side as well, and then that eclipsed everything else.
How did you come to the subject of history for your comics? You were a history major in college, right?
Yes, I was.
So let's start by, how did you come to the subject of history as just an interest in your life?
Oh, since way back. That's like, you know, why do you like the things that you like? You just do. You've liked them for so long, you forget why. and I've always been interested in that. And it maybe it's because, you know, history and culture is such a big part of Nova Scotian identity sometimes. And or maybe it's just because I'm a dork. I don't know. I always, like, you know, my dad and I would watch the old, like, whatever was on that had anything to do with history, we're like, leave it here. Like, we really want to watch this. And I just went for it all the time. I would get my hands on books to read, and was fascinated by old things and old stories and folklore and all that kind of stuff. And it made sense to go to university for history. I was a double major in history and anthropology, but it really wasn't a tough decision.
There's something about the history comics. There's sort of this recurring theme, which is that, you know, some of the jokes are about events, but a lot of the jokes are about just the disconnect between us totally understanding that human beings are just human beings that are like human beings, but also that there were times when things were completely different in ways that are completely non-understandable to us now.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun to juxtapose those things. And it really, I don't know, it kind of helps put things in perspective. And it's like, it's an obviously a good setup for a joke. But hopefully sometimes you can do it in a way that makes you think about then and now, and have a little fun at the same time.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the cartoonist Kate Beaton. Her webcomic, Hark a Vagrant, has been collected into a book. She brings her distinctive wit to a cast of characters that is primarily drawn from history and old literature. I want to ask you about the aesthetics of your work.
Sure.
One of the things that's interesting to me about the world of webcomics relative to the world of comic strips, like newspaper joke comics, is that the aesthetics are so much more varied on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, you have that freedom.
Do you think that people who are writing for comic for newspapers are getting, is it because they're getting funneled into a specific aesthetic, or is it, I mean, how does that divergence happen?
I don't know. I was a guest this year at the Rubin Weekend, which is the National Cartoonist Society gathering where all the newspaper cartoonists are. It was amazing to meet them. You know, you never expect to meet the person who does Marmaduke, but there he is.
It's hard to even imagine that Marmaduke comes from a person.
Yeah, right? It's like some of those things you just take for granted. They've just been there forever. I watched a man drawing, and there was like a crowd of his friends around chuckling, and then you lean in closer, and it was just Dennis the Menace's head. You just never, ever expect to see that in your life, and it was amazing. But they all, like, the thing about it is they're all very proud of their work, and they're good at their jobs, which is, you know, it's not an easy job to have this strip of characters that's a bit, like, it's limited to a certain amount, I guess. And to do that day after day for years, following the rules of the syndicate, which is, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of things you need to abide by there. and so then, you know, you get the impression that that we're just were just running on different tracks, you know. That's what they wanted to do. And for a lot of them, that's what was available to cartoonists. There was no web comic, and there was not a lot of indie comics. I think that in the last 10 years, like, there's been this crazy emergence of comics into a bigger thing, into a more mainstream thing, you know. And I just think that now there's more options. And there are still people who want to do newspaper comics, and there are people who want to do other things.
Newspaper comics are this very specific kind of challenge. The mm-hmm. challenge is you create this, you have to create a kind of iconic character in some way, something that someone would want to put on a t-shirt. And then you have to write a new joke for that character every day forever.
It's hard. it would drive me insane because I can't keep my brain in one spot. It's always got to go somewhere else. I even felt constrained by doing only historical comics for a while. I realized that I could do whatever I wanted, and I broke out of that and felt much better.
I want to ask you about that, though, because, you know, one of the things is a newspaper comics artist can say, look, I work for a syndicator and they send my work to newspapers mm-hmm. and it's my job to deliver this one particular thing, mm-hmm. which is its own kind of challenge, certainly. But you can kind of, if you're in that position, you can kind of throw off the responsibility for everything else onto the man. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely can.
And when you're creating a webcomic, you're in this position where if you do something that isn't what your readers want from you, it means there's a direct relationship between that and you, whatever, not eating.
Yeah, the line between the artist and the audience on the internet gets very, very thin. And people expect to have access to you in a certain way, and it's important. You need, like, in order to succeed online, you really need to sort of foster an audience that wants to support you. You need to build a relationship with them. It's important. And then if you're doing it well, then if you change your mind about certain things or you go in a different direction, then they'll be on your side, you know.
Early on in your career, you did a fair amount of your output was autobiographical comics, and you have moved decidedly away from that. Was there a point where you were uncomfortable with how you were sharing yourself with a public that you increasingly could see either, you know, on your computer screen or at a, you know, convention or whatever?
I became conscious of the fact that my audience was growing a lot, and it, you know, the ones about myself, to a small audience, it seemed like a kind of like a nice personal thing, and to a bigger audience, it was just like laying yourself out, and it meant different. And I also wanted to take the focus away from me. Initially, the website was called katebeaton.com because I figured that my friends would be able to find that and remember it, and then I wanted to retreat away from that and take the focus off of myself. Because it just wasn't what I wanted to do, you know. I like doing autobiographical stuff because I like reading autobiographical comics, but I didn't want it to be the thing that I was known for, the main focus. I wanted people to come in to see the comics and to like them and not really think about me as much.
You have you've published work in the New Yorker.
Yeah.
I'm going to describe the scene in this cartoon, and I'm guessing that without having it in front of you, you can deliver the punchline. Mm. It's some cowboys enjoying a pot of beans around a classic cowboy campfire. One of them is being served by an older lady with giving him a scoop full of beans.
Mm. I thought we agreed. No moms.
I know that, like, thousands of people submit cartoons to the New Yorker mm-hmm. every week, since it's one of the only venues that runs that kind of cartoons that is, you know, pays and has prestige and so forth. How is it different to write that kind of piece rather than writing for an audience that is so deeply engaged with you and your work?
I didn't write those. The New Yorker cartoons were a partnership between me, God, bad grammar, me and, no, Sam Means and I. Sam Means is a writer. He works for The Daily Show, and he has worked for The Onion and Weekend Update and that sort of. He knows what he's doing with comedy stuff. And we were looking for something to do together, and I also wanted to challenge myself. So I didn't write those, but he would send the ideas, and we would go back and forth with a draft or two, and then have the finished product to submit. And yeah, it was different. I was used to just putting things up because I could. And I guess I wanted that validation of an editor saying this is good enough to get in. And to challenge myself to become a better artist, because you work differently when you're trying to impress somebody, and impressing them means getting published or not. And also composition skills and everything turn into a different ball game when it comes to a single panel comic. But yeah, you are going for a different audience, and you're not even going for the New Yorker audience. You're going for the New Yorker editor. That's who you want to slip it past. You try to go for a certain aesthetic, I suppose, and maybe an idea that there is a New Yorker sense of humor, like there is a New Yorker style joke. And I kind of adhered to that. But then recently I was on a comics panel with Roz Chast, who is an extremely nice lady. And she was like, you should just do what you want to. You don't have to make a New Yorker cartoon. You should just make what you want to make, because that's what she does.
Well,
she's
easy
amazing.
For Roz Chast to say, right?
Yeah, well, I suppose so, huh? But it's true as well, because, you know, I don't know. One part of me thinks, well, like, you want this as a, if you want to do this as a job, or if you want to keep this up, then you should adhere to a certain aesthetic or a certain line of humor. And then the other part says, why don't you just do what you want?
More with Kate Beaton after a break. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. Gift memberships available. Shipments begin December 1st with delivery before Christmas. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com. Hey folks, it's me, Jesse. The blog at MaximumFun.org is livelier than ever. That's right. The days of me just posting two hip-hop videos every week are over. If you haven't been to MaximumFun.org in a while, or if you've never been, now's a great time to check it out. Rebecca O'Malley is our new blogger. Forum goers might know her as Resilient Rabbit. And because of her, we've got tons of great stuff at MaximumFun.org. You can find great Overlooked comedy videos, commentaries, a comprehensive alumni newsletter, updates on past guests on the show, and even live dates every week for everyone who's ever been on The Sound of Young America, organized by place. So wherever you live, you can find something good to do this week. Not to mention, of course, Colin Marshall's Pod Thoughts podcast reviews, a great place to find out about new great podcasts. And don't worry, I am still posting two rap videos every week. Use your web browser, subscribe to the RSS feed, whatever. It's all online at MaximumFun.org. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the cartoonist Kate Beaton. Her webcomic, Hark a Vagrant, has been collected into a book. Instead of being about talking dogs and cats, her strips tend to be about things like the Bronte sisters and the War of 1812. I have this friend who works in comic book publishing, and he told me the number of people in the United States that regularly read comic books. Now, I don't remember what it was, but it was like 500,000 or something like that, or 200,000 and 300,000.
Yeah.
It was
A best-selling comic book is like 100,000 or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a number that shocked me at how small it was.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's because, you know, I distribute a lot of my work on the internet when it's not on the radio, and so maybe I just have a disproportionately comic book aware audience. But you've done some traditional or non-traditional versions of traditional superhero comics.
Yes.
And I wonder what your experience was of coming to that as a person who, despite being a comics creator, didn't come from deep roots in comic book world. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like that kind of like I have every episode, every issue of Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah, for sure. No, there was like, you know, when I grew up, there's just no comic book stores around. I think the nearest one was probably four hours away. And I didn't set foot in until I was in my 20s. So I blissfully unaware of a lot of that stuff, except for watching Batman cartoons, maybe. But I find it fascinating. I find the whole thing really interesting, and the readers really sort of move me. I don't know, when you go to a comic show and you see the people dressed up and excited, they're just having fun. Like it's so nice to see these people just wanting to have fun and like enjoying the thing that they enjoy the most with a crowd of other people. So I think that the superhero stuff is really like interesting, and I like learning about it. So I enjoy making comics about it, because you also kind of make comics about people's relationships with the character, not just the character themselves, which is always, I guess, maybe one of my favorite ways to approach a topic in the first place. I got to do Strange Tales for Marvel, which is they put out these comics that indie writers and artists make, and you can just take any Marvel character that you like and make a small comic about it, and it gets published by Marvel, and it is really fun. There's all these kind of like backwards and interesting takes on the characters, and people enjoy it, and I like reading about it, and I like kind of poking fun at things, I don't know, it's yeah.
Let's talk about one of the stories that you did. I read some of this one that you did that starred Rogue,
yeah.
from the X-Men.
Yeah.
So first of all, tell me what made you pick this character out of all of the thousands of characters, including many that are sort of inherently funny because of their ridiculousness. And then tell me what the story that you told with her was.
Sure. I had picked already Kraven the Hunter, and I needed to do two. And Kraven Hunter's from Spider-Man, and he's really hilarious. And then I kind of wanted to do female, so like I had a good combo. And I went through a bunch of female characters, like Kitty Pryde is very well-loved by audiences. And I thought that the disco one was really funny. What was her name? Dazzler. She like has disco powers. She was amazing. And then I settled on Rogue because I liked her power. She just like, if she touches someone, she takes their power away from them and she absorbs it herself. So if you could fly, she'd touch you and then she can fly and you're kind of sick for a while. So in the comic, well, I thought like, you know, if you're a regular person and she touches you, what happens? I don't know. But in the comic, she's like dancing to headphone music and unaware of her surroundings, and she tips over a vase, and it's Professor X's favorite, and he can hear it because he's super genius. He hears everything. I don't know. He has a big computer that tracks his vases, and he could sense that it was Rogue because he could feel like guilt or whatever. I don't know. And less school than Professor X, and he went looking for her, and she's like, "Oh no, I'm gonna get in trouble. I got to do something quick." And there's a kitten on the floor. So she's like, "I'm sorry, kitten. I have to take your powers." And she touches it. And then she gets these huge, like adorable eyelashes and big moon eyes and like a super cute face. And she's just radiating like adorable. And then he comes around the corner and he's about to get super mad. And he's like, "Oh, look at you. Like, I can't stay mad at you. You're so cute, and he starts petting her head. So she gets away with it because she stole the kitten powers.
You made this great thing. I Twittered that you were going to be on the show, and about seven different people sent me links to this great thing that you did with a couple of other webcomics creators.
Female characters?
Yes, exactly. And I want to talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
Tell me first, where did this come from? Did it come from, I know it came from a Twitter conversation, but I couldn't find the, you know how Twitter
no,
is.
No, actually, it came from, we were at Carly Minardo's house, Meredith Gran, Carly, why can't I say her name? Carly Minardo and myself. And it was like a party, and Carly drew for a friend the pose that I often draw, that hilarious comic pose where you can see the butt and the boobs at the same time, and she's like supposed to be functioning like a human being.
There's an astonishing amount of use of the like three situations in someone's life where someone might twist their torso as far as it will go.
Yeah, like a horrifying like exorcist thing. And I've seen figure like I think, oh gosh, any kind of pose, climbing a ladder, fighting, jumping, just standing around, just I don't know. So anyway, Carly drew that, and then we all started drawing it. We all started drawing like these characters and tried to make them the worst possible thing, and had a lot of fun with it because they're just like, you know, when you have people like somebody hands you, and they're like, here ladies, or here whatever, and just. Is this strong female character for you, and sometimes they're just horrible, just horrid people who have no personalities, and they just shoot guns and have sex, and they have like they're like robots, like weird, terrible psychopaths. And
don't hold back, Kate.
I know, no, I won't. So we just that's what these characters that we made, their jobs, they're supposed to be fighter pilots, which is why they're wearing, like, extremely vague pilot-looking things. Someone has a pair of goggles and, like, a hat, and someone has a helmet, and mine has, like, a jumpsuit or something. But the ass is cut out of the jumpsuit, and the boobs are just sort of hanging out. And they're really tough and cool, so one of them just has, like, sunglasses for a bra, and one has sunglasses on her face, and then another pair on top of her head. And one has a bra made just of bullets, and they have a lot of attitude, and they're horrible people.
I mean, there's it's a commentary on this kind of weird construct of what positive female role models or feminism is,
yeah.
As created by a bunch of dudes whose interests are sex and violence.
I guess so. I don't know. But you see examples of that kind of thing all over the place. And it's just funny when someone hands up to you and says, you know, yeah, I really love this character. And I think that, you know, she's a great female lead or whatever. And you're just like looking at what they're showing. You're like, why are you trying to trick me?
Can you tell me and our audience what the names of the strong females are?
Oh, they're awful. They're awful.
I was trying to figure out like which parts of them I might have to bleep on the radio, but I think I'll suffice it to say that they are weirdly vulgar. But go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Well, the one with bullets for a bra, her name is Georgia O'Queef, and the one with eye patches on her boobs and a pair of sunglasses on her head and on her face is Susan B. Anthony. And the one who's she's wearing almost next to nothing and has like a sunglasses for a bra and goggles on, her name is Queen Elizatitz. And we just wanted to get all of the like vulgar female body parts in there. it was a challenge to come up with a name that was like bam bam bam, and awful, just terrible. It's fun to make terrible things sometimes.
I get the feeling that the world of web comics, as someone who's not super steeped in it, mm-hmm. It is a lot more open to. feminine audiences and aesthetics and tastes and creators, then, I mean, it's a, you know, it's a modest achievement to be more open to those things than the world of superhero comic books. Mm. But you know, even newspaper comic strips are still very, it's a very, very male world with relatively few exceptions. Where do you think that comes from? Or if it's actually true, or if I'm,
I don't know.
Tell me
I
if I'm making it up.
It's a much more even playing field when it comes to indie comics in general, and I suppose I would put webcomics in that category. But it's just, I guess, the idea that, like, especially online, anybody can make a website. So why wouldn't anybody? Like, who's going to say no? So everybody does. Like, no matter who you are, there's no barriers there at all. And if it's good, it's good. That's all it needs to be. It's just if it's a good comic, then it kind of rises to the top, and that's the main criteria.
People really have a deep connection to you when you make something like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's something where it is really an important part of their identity in a way that, I don't know, Kathy or Marmaduke.
Well, people have a really personal reading of history, and I totally understand that. I definitely have, you know, your own personal heroes or whatever. And if you write something about somebody from a certain city or a certain country, somebody feels represented by their interest then, or, you know, your personal hero or whoever. Because obscure is a really relative term. It just means that someone doesn't know about it, but to somebody else, it's their most favorite thing, and they're so happy that this thing that they love so much is being shared in this way with other people and celebrated, because that's really what the comics kind of do. And so that's why I wanted to start, if I can. I always say this, but you know, branching out into places that I'm less familiar with. I'm so entrenched in Canadian, British, American type history, and I have readers from all over the place, and they just, you know, if you put something up, I put a comic up over the summer about Mexican history, and you get all these emails with, like, I'm so glad that you did, and it, you know, he's my favorite, and I loved it, and I thought it was so funny because you were represented, you know. It's nice to include people in the same way that I used to include my friends in my Facebook photos. Comics. It's nice to give that feeling, and maybe it's because I'm from Canada, which is kind of an underrepresented place in the great big area of entertainment and popular culture, and because almost a lot of your history is very sort of popular culture type stuff, and ours isn't, but people like it, and they like it when it's made, you know, kind of fun and accessible and good and something that you could share and that everybody can like.
Kate Beaton, I sure appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you very much.
Hey, no, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Kate Beaton's comic strip is called Hark a Vagrant. It is now collected in a gorgeous and hilarious book from Drawn and Quarterly. Kate, thanks one more time.
Hey, thank you.
That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Our editor is Nick White. Our intern is Colin Walzak. That's Colin with two L's for those of you keeping score at home. If you have thoughts about the show, you can always send me an email. My email address is jesse@maximumfun.org. And always remember, all good radio hosts have a signature sign-off.